Right, so using this strategy that we've just discussed, this approach, we're going to be looking at the Parsha today, the Parshat HaShavua, the weekly Torah reading. And I thought I would just say a few words about the whole idea of a weekly Torah reading. And this is understood. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. You know, we have this, the Torah. And the Torah scroll, which is the Word of God. This is described by Maimonides, by the Rambam, as a kind of dictation, a divine transmission to Moshe. And Moshe wrote down the Torah scroll, and the way in which he wrote it, the first part of it was written just before he ascended Mount Sinai, before the giving of the Torah. And then the rest of it, after the giving of the Torah, was written bit by bit as the sanctuary was there. There was a kind of divine dictation coming to him from the Holy of Holies in the sanctuary. And on the last day of his life, he completed the end of the Torah, and then it was a complete Torah, and he made copies of it and gave them to the different tribes. And it's something sacred. It is sacred in every letter, and the Talmud explores the idea that the entire Torah teachings that were given to Moshe on Mount Sinai during the 40 days and nights that he was there, they are all hinted at within the Torah. So that Leka midi in Aramaic, Leka midi de lo remiza boraita. There is no thing which is not hinted at in the Torah. So no thing of Torah law. So it's all there in the Torah. And then we have the Zohar telling us that the entire Torah is a divine name, a divine name. And Nachmanides says, not in the singular but in the plural, the Torah, divine names, a stream of divine names. And it's just remarkable that these divine names are broken up in such a way that we can read a story. And so we can read an account. But really it's something mystical on the highest level. And so from there we can understand the significance of the concept of not letting 3 days go by without reading the Torah. So the Torah is read on Shabbat twice, because in the morning there's the Parshat HaShavua, there's the Torah reading for that week, and in the afternoon is the beginning of the Torah reading for the next week. Then on Monday is again the Torah reading for the next week, for the next Shabbat, and on Thursday. So Shabbat, Monday, Thursday, at least, there is always a Torah reading. Then when there's Rosh Chodesh, when it's a fast day, when it's a festival, when it's Hanukkah, there's always a further Torah reading, Purim. But at least those three times a week, Shabbat, Monday, Thursday. So there aren't 3 days without the Torah reading, and there's always this continuous flow of the Torah. And the idea of the Seder of the week, that's like a every drasha, every occasion. It can be a happy occasion, a wedding, God forbid a tragic occasion, a funeral, whatever it is, something will be drawn from the Sedra of the week. There will be something or other opposite to that situation. And the layers of commentary and midrash, which unpack different meanings within it, these give all kinds of possibilities to find a continuous flow of guidance and inspiration from the Sedra of the week. And there is a Chabad practice of studying the Sedra of the week each day with Rashi's commentary. So Rashi's commentary, as we have it here in the traditional layout of the Chumash, there we have Rashi, then there's Ibn Ezra, there's Ramban, Or HaChaim, various Sforno, but so Rashi's commentary with a commentary on Rashi printed here as well, Siftei Chachamim, which is a digest of many other commentaries on Rashi. There are a large number of commentaries on Rashi. The Maharal of Prague wrote a commentary on Rashi.
Commentary,
what's sometimes called a super commentary.
And the Golem wrote the commentary about the Maharal.
So that's so the idea of studying each week that section of the Torah with Rashi's commentary on it. And the Chafetz Chaim, that's a Chabad custom. The Chafetz Chaim, who was not a Hasid, but he wrote a letter saying that in order to prepare the Jewish community for the Messiah, it is important that people should study in exactly the same way. Each day, that part of the Parshat HaShavua with Rashi's commentary. And so he also recommended this approach. So that means there's a constant exploration of Parshat HaShavua. So I think it's certainly a reasonable idea that when we come together, we should look at that. And so that's why this week we are looking at Toldot. And so let's see what we have in Toldot.
Now I should have had it on the iPad.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Oh, you got it here.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Brilliant. What a world.
Which chapter is it?
So it's chapter. One second. Let me tell you which chapter. It's 25, chapter 25, verse 19. That's the beginning.
Of Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis. Genesis 25, verse 19.
Ve'ele
Toldot. Yeah, do you want to read, Minnie?
Ve'ele Toldot Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham holided Yitzchak. ויהי יצחק בן 40 שנה וקחתו את רבקה בת בתואל הארמי מפדם ארם אחות לבן הארמי לא לאישה.
Right, you want to translate?
How would you translate Toldot? Chronicle. This is a chronicle of Yitzchak, son of Abraham. Abraham gave birth to Yitzchak. Yitzchak was 40 years old when he took Rivka, bat Betuel, daughter of Betuel ha'arami, the Aramaic, Mipadan Aram, Achot Lavan, sister of Lavan, Ha'arami, Lavan Ha'arami, Loleisha, for himself, as a wife.
Right. It's interesting that the translator here has translated Toldot as chronicles. Normally, Toldot means generations. And in fact, Rashi says that when it says these are the generations of Yitzchak, it means Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau, who are going to be spoken about later on. So it's normally when it says these are the generations, it tells you immediately who it is, but it's delayed because we're going to come in the next few verses to the idea of Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau. And so I think let's take it a little bit further. Nigel, would you like to read?
My Hebrew is not very good. Do you want to
read it in English?
I'm afraid Isaac left it too late to get married, no?
40. Yeah.
40, isn't that too bad actually? No. They used to get married later, didn't they?
Is that, I don't know.
In the biblical time, you know, first of all, at an earlier age, everything was much later. But it's at the time of Abraham that this sort of the time becomes more similar to ours. And nonetheless, Yitzchak, you see, there was the worry of who would Yitzchak marry. Abraham had been sent by God away from his own people into the land of the Canaanites. And he knew that his son should not marry a Canaanite woman. So therefore, in order to find a wife for Yitzchak, for his son Isaac, he had to send his servant, this was in last week's Sedra, he back to the east to Abraham's own family, who are descended from Shem. Noah had three sons, Cham, Shem, and Yafet. So we understand Shem as being the ancestor of Abraham's family, the Semites. And Cham as being the ancestor of the Hamitic peoples, like the Canaanites, the people of Canaan who were there in the land of Israel, the Egyptians, they are the Ethiopians, they are Hamitic peoples. And Yefet we see as the ancestor of the white European peoples. And somehow or other everyone else in the East and so on, they all fit in with among these three sons. So Abraham wanted someone from his own family, and that is a theme. In last week's Sedra, that theme is introduced very powerfully, because Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, he is a Canaanite himself. He is a Canaanite servant of Abraham. And Abraham is telling him, go to find a wife from my own family in the east. And he says, what if I can't, the person I find won't agree to come all this way to the west into the land of Israel? Then what should happen? And should I take a daughter from the children of Canaan, of the Canaanite? No, said Abraham. No, not the children of Canaan, if not someone from my own family there, we will have to take some of the children, the daughters of Lot, or the daughters of Ishmael, somehow or other, someone else within the family. He was very concerned that it should be within that family, even though it's only Abraham who is actually serving God. All the others are somehow his cousin. His Lavan is an idolater. But nonetheless, it's better that it should be his daughter. And so here we have Rivka, his sister actually. So here is Rivka, and so he's married to Rivka, and now they are worrying about children. And it's a very interesting thing that throughout the Torah, that somehow this problem about having children, it's a major issue. And so would you like to read it in?
Sure, I'll try to read it well.
Okay.
V'yata Yitzchak v'danoi l'nocheach ishto ki achra hi v'yata lo adnoi v'tahe Rivka ishto.
Yes. Do you want to read the translation?
Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebecca, his wife, conceived.
Right. So Yitzchak is praying to God. Now, the word for praying is an interesting word, vayeta. What is eter in Hebrew? Does anyone know? Millie, what would you think of eter?
Eter?
Ein tafresh.
Atarti.
It's not.
Well, that's using it in the same way. Atarti, heatarti. I pleaded, I begged.
Begged, yes.
But it was a restaurant.
Atar. Well, atar with an aleph is a site, like a website.
Agree, appeal.
A what?
Appeal or agree?
To appeal or to agree.
Oh, to appeal, also, right.
Also, yes.
Well, there's an older word, etel, which means a shovel. And the idea is that the prayer changes. It digs in and to the decree, to the divine decree, and turns it over. The
way you can, et in Hebrew.
Well, et is
shovel is et.
Et.
Yeah.
So okay. It's not from. Also, it is from the word shovel. That's right. But,
Yes. So that's how the sages describe it.
Very interesting.
Are you trying to say that like the plea is so deep it shovels it?
That's right. The point of prayer is that it changes the situation. The situation that God has set in motion or has implanted in existence is one particular structure. Then comes the prayer. And the power of prayer is that it changes.
Yes, of course.
Now that is a remarkable concept, and in fact that's worth spending a little bit of time on, because here we have the idea that Hashem granted this prayer, Vayeta lo Hashem. Now you have the idea that Yitzhak is praying opposite his wife. As Rashi puts it, he's standing in one corner praying and she's standing in the other corner praying. And then God answers his prayer. And Rashi says that's because of the spiritual power that Isaac has got. Isaac has an extra dimension of spiritual power because he is the son of Abraham. So there is this sort of charisma, inherited charisma, an inherited spiritual force, which enables him particularly to have this power of prayer. However, we see the power of prayer in the book of Job with a non-Jew having the power of prayer. Because at the end of the book of Job, God is angry with the three friends of Job who tried to comfort him. Job is not Jewish. But God is angry with the three friends who tried to comfort him and kept saying to him, well, it must be you really weren't so good as you claim, or things like them, Job's comforters. And so then God says, Job should pray on behalf of those three friends to save them, otherwise God's wrath will be exercised against. And Job prays for them, and he himself is healed, and as a result of his prayer. So it's so the power of prayer is something very significant, and the idea is that there is the level of ratzon is the will, and the will represents the level of keter, the crown. So there's this level of keter. Then below that comes wisdom, understanding, knowledge, the different spherot. So that's bina, chokhma, bina, dat. Yes, and then the other spherot. Now, at this point, things divide into this way to the left, severity, or to the right, kindness. But we say, when we are praying, we say, Yehi Ratzon, may it be the will of God. So what we are somehow doing is ascending to the level of the will and getting a new flow down, that it should come to the other side, instead of it being to the left, that they cannot have children, like severity. It should be to the right, the kindness, that they can have children. So we somehow have the power to ascend to that level of will. And we say, Yehi Ratzon Milfanecha, may it be your will, O God, that's such and such. And so it's somehow by our heart and soul reaching upwards to the divine that we are able to change the situation. That's I was once very late to give a shiur group in the West End on a lunchtime. I give a lunchtime group on Thursdays. So I was in a cab, and the traffic was absolutely packed. And I said to the driver, you drive as fast as you can. He was an African driver. You drive as fast as you can, and I will say Psalms. He said, right, okay. The interesting thing was, there had been chock-a-block traffic, and suddenly the traffic disappeared. We had this clear road. I think it was his belief. It was the power of his belief.
Because when he saw you, he believed in everything.
What was the psalm?
What was the psalm?
you just open the book of psalm and you read.
Yeah, I mean a good psalm when there's a problem.
Related to traffic.
Psalm 20 relates to any problem. Ya'ancha Hashem liyom tzara. May God answer us on a day of pain, of a problem. So in general, Psalm 20 helps. God forbid if someone is ill, we say Psalm 20 seven times, then say the name of the person. But
in the event of heavy traffic, you said Ma'amakim Keraticha
Hashem. From the depths, I call it. Add the name of the street. Mima'amakei Camden Road. From the depths of Canada. Anyway, so now she has conceived, and the sense of spiritual contact with God in the whole process of conception is something again we meet again and again in the Torah. In fact, the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, that it's because of the great sanctity of the patriarchs and the matriarchs that when they made love, it was something so spiritually significant that it's often written about in the Torah. They made love together, and she conceived. It's vayavor, this kind of concept. And it's because every step that they made was holy. However, now, vayitrotzatzu, would you like to go on? Vayitrotzatzu.
Vayitrotzatzu, avani bekirba. ואותו אומר, כן, למה זה אנוכי? ותלך לדרוש את השם. But the children clash inside her, and when this occurred, she asked, why is this happening to me? She went to seek a message from God.
Right. So in other words, it's a very difficult pregnancy. She's got twins inside her, and the twins are somehow fighting together. So... Yes.
You can just imagine. I had one that was kicking a lot, but can you imagine two fighting in there?
Well, Rashi says they were fighting.
I remember it from my childhood.
Yes.
When she was walking by a pub, yes, Esau was getting berserk. When she was passing by a yeshiva, Isaac was the one who was more active.
Jacob, yes.
Jacob, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's quite right. Yes, so not a pub, but an idolatrous temple.
Okay.
So Esau had this great desire to enter the idolatrous temple. So if she walked near an idolatrous temple, Esau struggled to get out. And as you say, when she went past the yeshiva where people like Shem and Eber were studying Torah, so Jacob. Of course, you can ask a question about this.
So if this story goes like that, how can you square it with the Torah only being given quite a long time later?
Ah, now this is a constant idea.
Yes.
That first of all, the Torah... Kadmal Olam, the Torah came before the world. So much so that in order to create the world, Istakel Boraita Uvara Alma, God looked into the Torah and created the world.
I mean, the Torah was the instructions.
The Torah is described in the Zohar as the blueprint of the world. A word is used for the architect's plans. And that's what the Torah is. So the Torah is the architect's plans for the world, And godly, it's the source of energy. It's the source of a divine energy coming down into a material form. And so from the Torah is a kind of a stage in this transformation, in this ethereal energy, which is beyond any possibility of physicality, being drawn down and creating a world which is finite, where we are surrounded by physical things and with finite dimensions. And the Torah is as kind of a step towards that. Because within the Torah, there's the world. The Torah speaks about the sun, the moon, the stars, existence, man. So trees, fish. So everything then comes from the Torah. And the Torah has within it the statement that God said, let there be light, let there be a firmament, let the waters part, and let there be dry land, and let there be vegetation, let there be animals, and so on. So those words of describing creation are actually the fountain of energy which is forming creation. So in that sense, the Torah exists before the world. Now then we have the world. And Adam was very close to God. And then we have Noah. Noah communicated with God. And Shem, his son, is understood and described as a priest of God. Shem is a priest, a Kohen Bekel Elyon, a priest of the Most High God, of the High God, of the Exalted God. And that is Shem, the son of Noah, who is called Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem. Malki Tzedek, the king of righteousness, the king of a place called Shalem, which is understood to be Yerushalayim,
yes.
Jerusalem. That's the great focus of world attention for a few thousand years. It's amazing, you know, how one city can be in the news, you know, the Crusades, all kinds of things focused on Jerusalem. It's hypnotic. It's somehow a totally magnetic spot in the world. So there is Malki Tzedek, the king of Shalem, and so the idea is that he taught Torah. And he and his grandson, Ever, they ran a kind of yeshiva where they studied godliness. They learned about godliness. At this time, there's understood to be the Book of Creation, Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, which is attributed to Abraham. And the idea of studying these teachings about how God creates the world and the relationship of God to existence and the seven Noahide laws. And you can, I saw just recently, I must acquire a set, two quite thick volumes in Hebrew expounding the seven Noahide laws. So with all kinds of detail from Talmud and codes of law, and it's, you know, so this kind of material could be studied. So that's a constant refrain, and you know, all the time.
But sorry, to your question, how did this start? Your question was?
Well, they studied Torah, and just before we started, Dali was telling us about Moshe having finished writing the Torah down.
Yes. And then the waiting?
But the point, of course, is that
this is before Moshe
was a few hundred years, many hundred years later. So, in physical terms, it's not the same parchment as it were.
Right, but in conceptual terms,
it's already there.
Yes. I mean, the way Nachmanides, Rambam, describes it in his introduction to his commentary on the Torah, which has been translated into English and is available. The original Torah HaKadumah, the primeval Torah, was written in letters of black fire on a background of white fire. And so therefore the giving of the Torah and the writing of the Torah is tangible writing in this world of this ethereal dimension, which was so exalted. And so therefore the Torah is there in many senses. But there's another question over here. which the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked. How is it that God makes Esau yearn for idolatry, even when he's a baby in the womb? Does this mean that a person is condemned to be evil? Surely we say that there is free will given to a person. Hakol b'yedei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven. That's right, except for fear of heaven. So what does this mean, that Esau had this lust for idolatry or other negative things, even as an embryo? How do we square that with free will? What would you say?
Free will in the womb.
No, he was destined.
But is a really free will?
Still have a choice.
And, I mean, this is really a very, very profound question. Maybe we should have an evening on that, because it's so complex, and there even just as far as the Bible, in some way we are told that there isn't really, that it's all distant. You're supposed to believe and you have to follow whatever it is you have to follow, isn't it?
You can't speak for other people. I mean, you can only speak for yourself in these matters, really.
No, we're talking
as far as... when it comes to free will, because you can't understand.
Exactly.
Because you can say that someone else doesn't have a choice, if you want to say it. But all you can know is from your own experience, you do have a choice. I mean, the choice may be... You may be tempted to choose differently to someone else because of your predisposition, because you're more interested in X and Y, because that's your... But you still have a choice to do it. It could be that much harder for you to make a simple choice than someone else to make a simple choice because of the way your body is. But every moment in our lives, we have a choice. I have a choice to leave the room now. I mean, I don't do it, but exercising it.
And I think Nigel's spot on. That's exactly it. And that a person could be born with the most powerful propensity for something or other really negative. And his challenge and opportunity is to learn to control that, and he has the choice. Is he going to let that be expressed or not? Is he going to control it? And in fact, the Talmud does speak about this, you know, great figures who had terribly negative passions, but who managed to control those passions. And Rabbi Shneur Zalman in Tanya, he talks about, you know, different kinds of people. One person has a very heated desire for all kinds of things around him and has a real challenge in controlling it. And another person is very cold. His passions are very still and cold, and he has the opposite problem. You know, so there's always the question, as Nigel said, of how we're going to relate to that and how what we're going to make out of that basic material of our makeup.
But it's more than that. It's we're touching on the subject of evil. If some people are born that way, Hitler. Very, very simple example. I mean,
but
this is just a phenomenon that happened.
Nobody forced him to do what he did. But
we are moving into a different realm now. Was there a divine plan that this should happen? I mean, we're talking about a preposterous thing that happened. And why wasn't it stopped?
You know, I heard
There
is a thing that you are able to pick up on the web.
So you're working on the root of evil.
Well, yeah. But this is part of it. You see,
Esau. It's reasonable that Millie should bring that in. Now, earlier than Hitler was Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh enslaved the Jewish people in a terrible way. And on the website Chabad.org, they have a section, it says video, and there's a section called Living Torah. And one of the sort of latest of these Living Torah, they put on a new one each week. And so there are hundreds, you know, in the archive. And one of the most recent is a discussion by the Rebbe. It's videos of the Rebbe talking. And there's a discussion by the Rebbe of the whole idea of Pharaoh, God saying to Abraham that his children will be slaves in a land which is not theirs, and then and then eventually they will suffer there, and then eventually they will go free and they will come back to the land of Israel. Now, to what extent does this force, so the land which is not theirs, we generally understand because Joseph was sold into Egypt, and then his brothers and his father, they came to Egypt and they lived there. So it's Egypt. Egypt's the land. Did Pharaoh have the choice not to enslave the Jews? And the Rebbe presents a sort of a range of commentators who say different things. You know, one commentator says, well, maybe he had to enslave the Jews, but didn't have to be so nasty about it, didn't have to enslave them so much. The Rebbe himself, like, after presenting several different opinions, he says, you know, there is a halacha in Maimonides, a halachic teaching, that if a prophet makes a prophecy for something good to happen, and it doesn't happen, then you say he's a false prophet. Yeah. But if the prophet makes a prophecy for something bad, and it doesn't happen, you say, well, people repented, and so God didn't punish that city. Like with Jonah. Yeah. Jonah's whole problem was, I'm going to go to the city of Nineveh and I'm going to tell them God's going to destroy the city. I know that God's not going to destroy the city. You know what will happen? They're all going to repent and it won't happen. And that's exactly what took place. The Talmud says Jonah was actually worried that this would reflect badly on the Jewish people, because the people of Nineveh, when the prophet appears, they all take it very seriously, and they say, we've got to stop doing bad things, we've got to improve, we've got to change, and indeed God forgave them. Whereas the Jews, they get one prophet after another, they take absolutely no notice.
So true. But also,
hence Jonah's reluctant. So the Rebbe said, you know what? There could have been a prophecy that they will be in the country of Egypt and they will be afflicted there and enslaved. And Pharaoh could say, you know what? I'm not going to enslave them. I'm not enslaving anyone. He actually had free will.
But that's not what I hear on other occasions. God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Maimonides discussed this. God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yeah.
That was a punishment. The hardening of his heart was a punishment for the bad that he'd done previously. Because he'd acted in a bad way, right? He chose to enslave the Jews and afflict them in terrible ways. Because of that, his heart was hardened.
I'm talking about the negotiation between him and Moses and the ten plagues.
Yeah, but it's only after a certain stage that his heart is hardened. So
I know, but some commentary was sort of purposely done that they had to go through those motions. It's just that you hear. Yeah, but this is Judaism. It's the beauty of it as well, isn't it? You have different, really polarized ideas about it, completely polarized. And
well, one of the discussions that the Rebbe quotes, one of the suggestions is, it's not decreed on any individual Egyptian that he had to be cruel to the Jews. So any individual Egyptian could have said, I'm not going to be cruel to anyone. But the Rebbe says, yeah, but there's the king. If the king had not wanted to enslave them, then no one would have been enslaved. So,
but if we go further, Okay, we have all those wonderful, beautiful prophets and the prophecies. A lot of them end with wonderful ending, Be'acharit HaYamim, at the end of the days. But that doomed of destruction, and I mean, as if things will happen. So where is free will?
Well, usually
that's what I'm asking, where is free will?
Usually they're saying if. They're saying because people are serving idols, or they're doing this, or they're doing that, because of that there's going to be doom and destruction.
But it is written in a way that it is, this is the way it is going to happen. It is happening.
But you've got the if already in the Torah. There's one section where God says, I will do this and you will be do this. But if not, and then comes a list as long as you're armed, one more horrible than the other, if you don't, this sort of stuff. So that's already there. You have whether if you do this, but if you don't, then... So you can choose.
All right, well, there's
consequences.
Is it really a choice? I don't think so.
I think the lot is a bit earlier than that, but that's also a choice.
What did you say?
Lot and his
wife. Lot and his wife.
Yeah, she could have chosen not to turn around.
Right. Yeah. Nothing forced her to turn around. Yeah.
But Charlie, why do we assume that Esau is a negative character?
Right. Okay. We're coming back to Jacob and Esau. Why do we assume that Esau is a negative character? Okay, let's take this a little bit further then. So first of all, we have her going, the children are struggling inside her, and she goes to ask God, which means she goes to the yeshiva of Shem and Ever, and she asks them, what does this mean? Would you like to go on, Michael? Verse 23.
You can read it in English if you want.
I can bring my
God. Yomer Adonai Lashne Naim.
Goyim.
Goyim.
To Goyim.
Upikibne Ushne Ushne.
Shne.
Shne.
Yes.
Rumim. Mime Aich. Iparedu. Ulom. Ulyom. Milom Yamats Rav Yaakov Yavod Zair.
Yes. Do you want to translate them? That's verse 29.
That word to was two nations are in your womb, two governments will separate from inside you, the upper hand will go from one government to the other. The greater one will serve the younger.
Right. Now that statement is saying that there are these two powerful forces, Jacob and Esau, who are going to be born. And they are two forces which are struggling. And either one is in control or the other one is in control. And ultimately, the greater one or the older one will serve the younger one. So that's these two forces of Jacob and Esau. Now Jacob and Esau can be understood literally, Jacob the ancestor of the Jewish people, Esau the ancestor of many hostile nations. Amalek is a grandson of Esau, for example. And the land that became Esau's was basically Saudi Arabia, Seir. That is the descendants of Esau.
But today we equate Esau with the West, with the Church, with Greece.
Yes, it's an interesting thing that Esau becomes Rome.
How did because when I was growing up, from that I assumed that it was Saudi Arabia, this whole Arab thing, but obviously it's not.
Well, Sadia Gon makes a connection. he says that the beginning of Christianity was really the adopting of a religion which was a religion in Seir, in Saudi Arabia. And that became the religion of Rome. And so that's why there's this connection that Esav, who's Seir, Esav is Seir, which is Saudi Arabia, and that somehow makes the journey to Rome and becomes Rome. Because then we have the idea of Edom and Romi, that identification, that Esau is Rome, and we leave Ishmael to the Arabs.
Yeah.
Yes, that's,
Where does Christianity come from, Saudi Arabia?
Well, there's a lot of discussion what exactly Christianity is. There's, you know, with all the research on Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that, it's not at all clear that the religion called Christianity actually emerged among the Jews in such a simple way. It may well be an import of, you know, images and ideas, you know, a sacrificed man, you know, this could all be from somewhere else.
Puts aside the existence of Christ, who was in
Well,
Jerusalem.
The way the cultural forces work is that very often, you know, you have, it's like living midrash, if you like. You know, certain things happen and then they're given certain kinds of significance and you know, so where exactly this image comes from? You know, this it's not so clear that it's
you know. But Edom is certainly from Arabia.
Well, yes, in its in the way in which it's described in the Torah, it's in Arabia.
It was an interesting paper, a book written by a Jew and a monk and a Catholic, and the one thing that the Romans were very, very meticulous about was recording everything that happened. And apparently in the Vatican they are there all records of everybody who stole a loaf of bread. And these the stories, and certain people have access to these. But all the records for the period of Christ, no one has seen or allowed to or what have you.
It's in the vaults. One day they'll be open, I promise you. Mm. Not in our lifetime.
But why?
Well, because there's things about the origins of Christianity, which the Catholic Church doesn't want to come out.
Mm. And there was a period, there's no question about it, the Jews and Christians worshipped in synagogues.
You know, that's certainly so.
That's
a related phenomenon. But the point is that the Dead Sea Scrolls indicate that there was a religion very similar to Christianity before Christ.
But the ideas were not original with him, but there were already people practicing, groups practicing in the area.
Yeah, that's right. And
the expression.
The hatred of the Jews was there already. You know, there's the wars, the book of the wars of the sons of light against the sons of darkness, you know, which is one of these old scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
And who are the sons of light and the sons of darkness? Well, the sons of light are us, and the sons of darkness are those Jews who live in the city. That's, you know, we living in these caves.
When are they from? What time? What period? Those scrolls are?
A couple of centuries before the Common Era.
Right.
You know, so in other words, there are all kinds of spiritual phenomena, you know, spiritual type phenomena are going on. And, you know, how exactly, you know, one kind of narrative becomes popularized and achieves faith. All right, now, the presentation of Jacob and Esau as two different, the source of two different nations or group of nations, Jacob, the Jewish people, and Esau, the nations of the world, maybe the Western nations, the Jews and the West. But there's another way of reading this story, that Jacob and Esau are inside each of us, that we are the Jacob and the Esau. And it's in terms of we being inside, the Jacob and Esau inside us. That's how we have the power in the image, which is later in the Sefer, of Jacob dressing up in Esau's clothes and wearing these hairy skins of a goat in order to imitate Esau's hairiness. So there you have this idea of the way in which the Jacob dimension within the person is clothed in an Esau dimension. Now,
fascinating. It's like when it says Lech Lecha about Abraham. I could also see it as a spiritual thing. Lech Lecha, get out.
You
yourself.
Absolutely.
Go and find your core. Go and find that one thing.
That's
easier to explain.
So there's always this double dimension with the Torah. That on the one hand, it's speaking about things happening thousands of years ago, which is the ancient history of the Jewish people of the world. And on the other, it's the psychological map of each individual today. It's and the personal history of each individual today. Now, at the end of the pack that we've got, there are a couple of pages of Tanya. Let's have a look at that, from chapter 9 of Tanya. So after the Sedra of the week...
Sorry, just turn it around. That's in chapter 10. Turn it around, yeah, like that.
Yeah, no, well, now if you open it up, it's actually chapter 9 we're going to look at. So here we have the idea that there are two forces within the person.
Thank you.
Yeah, you've got that chapter 9?
This is from Tanya.
Tanya, yes.
Which is only a Hasidic book, right?
What do you mean by only?
Sorry. Meaning it's written by the Hasidic movement. It's not...
It's written by Rabbi Shlomo. Yeah.
I didn't mean...
you were not here at the beginning.
No, I was once speaking to a gentleman who... his home is filled with the most wonderful artifacts of... archaeological things from ancient Canaan and things of this kind, very like a museum, and I think he sells to museums. So I said, have you ever read Tanya? He said, Tanya's only 200 years old. Compared with these stones of 3,000 years, 4,000. So Tanya is a summary by Rabbi Schneur Zalman of the central teachings of the Hasidic movement, that's what it's saying, which are, in a sense, they are the core teachings of the spiritual dimension of Judaism. So there is the practical dimension, the halachic. Most people, when they study Talmud, are studying it in order to understand exactly what is the halacha. What should a person do? Mm-hmm. How do you make a sukkah? What constitutes a sukkah? What constitutes correct observance of Shabbat? But the spiritual dimension, which is there in the Zohar and in Kabbalistic books, is not so much what you do as the spiritual effect of what you do and the spiritual meaning of being commanded to do anything or of life itself and existence. And so in those terms, these are within Judaism, they are universal ideas, but they're the spiritual dimension. What makes it specifically Hasidic is that the Hasidim believed that these spiritual ideas should be communicated on a wide level, while the opponents of Hasidism subscribed to the basic same ideas, but said that they should be reserved for an elite of Torah scholars. They are the ones who should study these deep concepts. Other people should just know what they are supposed to do, not
Basically, this is the origin of where don't study the Zohar before 40 and stuff like that comes from.
That kind of thing, and then we have a movement begun really by Rabbi Isaac Luria that in fact these teachings are very important for everyone, and the Baal Shem Tov emphasized that strongly, and so it became in the Hasidic movement the emphasis on the communication of the spirit. Alright, so now he is looking in this chapter, he's looking at the what's called the animal soul and the divine soul. And the animal soul and the divine soul, basically, they relate to Jacob and Esau that we have in this section. Maybe I'll just read it in Hebrew and translate it. Yeah. So we're beginning of chapter 9. V'hine mekom mishkan nefesh habahamit. You have that?
It's right.
Yeah, it says 26 at the top of the page. Thank you very much. Right. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. The photocopier put one page upside down, which adds to the confusion. Does it say chapter 9, Nigel? Right. V'hine mekom mishkan nefesh habamit. Now the place where the animal soul dwells, shemiklipat noga b'cholish Yisrael, which is from the klipa called noga. So that's a particular kind of klipa. Klipa means shell.
Peel.
Yeah, that's right. Peel or shell. Exactly. It's the peel. It's the peel of holiness.
The outer covering.
Yes, that's right. So you've got like the nut, the kernel, which is the tangible holy, and then around the kernel there is peel or shell, which is inedible. I mean, there is a part which is edible actually, because for example, in an almond. The almond is covered, the ivory colored almond nut is covered with a brown skin. And that brown skin is edible. In fact, it's healthy. And then you have other parts of the almond which are inedible, the further levels of shell. So this describes the different kinds of shell. And so noga is the most superior kind of shell, but that is still the animal dimension. And who, in other words, the lusting, passionate, the one, the force which has got a propensity, a negative propensity. Hu belev b'chalal smoli, that is in the heart, in what is called the left hand chamber of the heart. Shehu male dam, which is filled with blood of passion. Uchtiv ki hadam hu hanefesh, and the blood is the desire of the person.
But nefesh is not desire.
Well, ein nafshi, you see the word nefesh means soul, and nefesh also means ein nafshi ela amazeh, my desire is not for this people.
So that's what he means here.
Yeah.
Right.
So, well, it's both, because the blood is the nefesh habahamid, the animal soul. V'lachem kol ha-ta'avot, so therefore all desires, v'hitpa'arot, and boasting, v'kas, and anger, v'domeim, and similar, hein belev, they are in the heart. U'mehalev, hein mitpashtot v'chol ha-guf, and from the heart, these passions spread through the whole body. V'gam ole la-moch she-barosh, and also rise up to the brain in the head, lachshov la-ha-hebehem, to think about them, ulhitchakem behem, to plan, kumo shehadam mekoro b'lev, just as the blood is based in the heart, u'malev mitpashet l'chol eivarim, and from the heart it spreads to all the limbs, v'gam ole lemoach sheberosh, and also rises up to the brain in the head. Now this is based on very ancient teachings, And it's interesting that this recognizes the circulation of the blood, which in Europe was only discovered by Thomas Harvey in the 16th century, but 17th century. Whereas here, there is the idea, he's just stated very clearly, that the blood starts off in the heart and it's pumped through the body. It flows to the brain. So in other words, we have, if we make a kind of a little diagram of this, we have heart and brain. So if we have the head of the person there, and then there's the heart. So the heart, it sends its passion into the brain, and there in the brain, the person starts thinking about it, what to do, how to act on this passion which is prompting him. And he is excited about whatever it might be, and he's planning how to get it. So he's cogitating in his mind how to put into practice what the heart is telling. Right. Now.
What's the business being human?
and that is like the Esau in the heart. The passionate Esau who's got this desire, even from the womb, it's got. Ach makom mishkan nefesh elokit, but the place of the dwelling of the divine soul, hu b'mochin shebarosh, that is in the brain, in the head. So there we have this divine soul, umisham mishpashetet l'chol ha'ivarim, and from there it spreads to all the limbs, v'gam b'lev. So that also spreads round the person and also reaches the heart.
The right hand part of the heart,
she'ein bo dam, in which there isn't blood, or it's not the same kind of blood. Now, what is actually happening in the heart is that the heart pumps blood to the lungs, and then it comes back from the lungs oxygenized, and then it's pumped round the body. So there's like good blood and bad blood. There's the blood which is oxygenized, and then there's the old blood which comes back and has to be re-oxygenized. So in the heart itself, you've got this positive and negative thing, but here it's describing it in spiritual terms, that you have the aspect of the heart which is negative passion, and then you have also the divine soul, which is a spiritual passion, the complete reverse, the joy in helping another person, the wish to save someone who is in a problem, when one hears about some catastrophe, what can I do in order to help, the wish to protect, which is the complete opposite to the Esau dimension, which is a wish to conquer and suppress and acquire. So there we have these two forces. As it says, the heart of the wise person is on the right. And what does that express? The Avat Hashem, love of God, like a burning flame, mitlahevet belev maskilim, burning in the heart of the wise person, hamavinim umitbonenim b'da'atam, who think and contemplate in their mind, asher b'mocham, in their brains, bidvarim hamo'orim et ha'ava, those things which arouse love. It's interesting, he's giving us the choice, because the person may want to think about lustful things, but instead he or she chooses to think about something spiritual and godly. V'chein simchat levav b'tiferet Hashem, and similarly the joy of the heart in the splendor of God, v'hadag ono. Ka'asher einei ha'chacham asher b'rosho, that when the eyes of the wise person looking b'moach chokhmato v'inato, through his wisdom or her wisdom and understanding, mistaklim b'yikarad malka, they gaze at the glory of godliness, v'tiferet gudulato, the splendor of the greatness of the divine, adein cheka, which is infinite, v'ein sof v'tachlit, without any limit or end, כמבואה במקום אחר, as explained elsewhere, וכן שעה מידות קדושות שבלב, and similarly all the other spiritual qualities of the heart, love and awe of God, they come from they come from chokhmah bin adad, wisdom, understanding, knowledge in the mind. Ach hinei ktif, but behold it's written. Now here we have a quote from our Sedra. So if we just turn over, I think you have to turn to a page which says at the top of the page, Yud Dalet. Yud Dalet?
I think.
So it's written in our Sedra, Ulo'om Milo'om Ye'ematz. That was the prophecy that she received. One nation will struggle against the other. Do you have it, Michael?
That's right.
Thanks, good. Right. So there it says, one nation struggles against the other. The two forces, the passion which is in the heart, the animal soul, the spiritual passion which is in the mind, which can be aroused in the mind, which is the divine soul. They are the two forces. And he goes on to say that it's like two forces which are struggling over one city. And each one of them is trying to conquer the city. And so we have these two forces within us. So now that is the Jacob and Esau inside each person. However, it is not a black and white picture. It's easy to read this narrative as if Jacob is good and Esau is bad. And of course, Esau does act in a bad way. The way the Midrash describes the activities of Esau, he serves idols, he kills people, he rapes women. When we look in the actual Torah text, it's more subtle. And what it tells us is that he marries Hittite women, which upset his parents, Isaac and Rebecca, very much. He marries Hittite women.
They meet more than one.
At this stage,
that's not the problem. Now, if you look on page 123 of the Torah text. Page 123, which is on the left. Wait, I think it's here. Is it there? What's this?
Yes.
Right.
Number 34.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, number 30. Yeah, that's right. Verse 34. Okay. Would you like to go on? Would you like to read that?
Vahi Esav ben 40 shana v'yakav. Isha et Yehudit bat Be'eri Hachiti ve'et Basmat bat Elon Hachiti Vatihien Morad Ruach Yitzchak Belavivka.
Right. Can you translate?
Yeah. When Isa was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Be'eri and the Hittite, and Basma, daughter of Elon the Hittite. his wives became a source of spiritual bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah.
Right. Now, why were they a source of spiritual bitterness? Because he's broken the whole thing of marrying within the family of Abraham. He's married Hittite women, which are Canaanite women. It's one of the families of Canaan. So one of the tribes. It's rather odd, though. Do you notice something odd about the name of one of them?
Well, you did.
Yes, Yehudit. She's a bit Jewish. Nothing is by chance.
No.
Nothing is by chance. At this stage,
yes,
the Jews are not called Yehudim. It's only much later on in the Tanakh that we find the word Yehudim, Jew, applied to the Jews. It's the book of Esther, which is the beginning of that, where the Jews are called Yehudim. But nothing is by chance, especially not in the Torah. So the fact that he's married a woman called Yehudit is saying something. Now let's look at the very end of the Sedra.
Sorry, so what does that say?
Okay, we're gonna come to another step which will help us understand this. Now we've passed by what happens in the Sedra is the whole issue of Jacob buying the birthright from Esau, Jacob getting the blessing instead of Esau by pretending to be Esau, and then Rebekah says to, and now Esau wants to kill Jacob, and Rebekah says to her husband Isaac, you know, I really don't want Jacob to marry one of these Hittite girls. She actually says, you know, that would be really terrible, and my wife wouldn't be worth living, my life wouldn't be worth living. She says, Rebekah, here, maybe Alan, would you like to take this? This on page 129. Sorry about the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Page 129.
Yes.
Right. So verse 46. Batomer Rivka, can you try that, or just in English, if you like? Verse 46, near the bottom of the page.
Okay, I'll do it in English.
Okay.
Okay. Rebecca says to Isaac, "I'm disgusted with life because of those Hittite women. If Jacob marries such a Hittite girl from the daughter of his land, of this land, why should I go on living?"
Right, she sounds just like a Jewish mother. If my son,
absolutely, she's a Jewish mama.
Yes, but it's a bit strong, isn't it?
Well,
yeah.
She doesn't want to.
Jewish mothers are very dramatic. They became the drama queens.
And so we have in the next line, Isaac summoned Jacob and gave him a blessing and charge, do not marry a Canaanite girl. Right? So he's sending him off to the east in order to marry a girl from their own family. Now if you just turn over, let's just see what Esau does, which is in verse 6, like right at the very end. Millie, would you like
Vayera?
Vayera Esau.
It's like 1 second, sorry.
Yeah,
not to worry,
yeah.
Sorry.
6.
It's okay.
Verse 6 on the last page.
Vayera Esau ki berech Yitzchak et Yaakov v'shilach otu padan Aram lakachat lo mishan isha. וברכו אותו, ויצב עליו לאמור, לא תיקח אישה מבנות כנען.
Right, translate that.
And when Esau saw that Isaac blessed Jacob and sent him to Padan Aram to take a wife there, וברכו, and when he blessed him, and ordered him not to take a woman, a Canaanite woman.
Okay, let's skip one sentence and go on to verse 8, Nigel. Vayari Isa.
Thank you. Vayara Isa ki Ra'ot Banot Kanaan Ban Bahinei Yitzchak Avir. Esau understood that the Canaanite girls were displeasing to his father Isaac.
Right, I'll go on. It's Vayelech, the last verse.
Vayelech asah et Yisrael Vayacheach et Mahalat Bat Yish Shamael Abraham Achot Nevot Nivayot Av Nasav Lo Leisha.
So he didn't marry Canaanite. So why are we making
this? He did. First marriage
earlier on.
But then he didn't divorce.
He just added on.
But now he's trying to repent.
No, he tries to please his father.
Well. Now this is a very interesting thing.
Ishmael.
Okay. So do you want to translate that?
First or the end. Meaning the last one.
Esau therefore went to Ishmael and married Machlath, daughter of Abraham's son Ishmael, sister of Nebaioth.
Right.
In addition to his other wives.
Yes. Now, on the one hand, the point is made, as you just made, he married her in addition to his other wives. He didn't divorce the first one.
But how could he divorce them? There was no revenue or no court. I mean,
there's the idea of sending away a wife. I mean, as we saw with Abraham and Hagar,
and
he sent Hagar away. So, even before, in the seven Noahide laws, it is understood that a man might marry a woman and then they might part again. And that's considered being together, being married, and then divorced. So a woman who has been sent away by a man who then sleeps with another man is not committing adultery, whereas if she is still with her original husband, she sleeps with another man, she is committing it. Anyway, the Talmud says, now, so in other words, he's married a granddaughter of Abraham. He's married a granddaughter of Abraham.
He stayed in the family.
The daughter of Ishmael, of Ishmael. The sages say, why is she called Machalat? The word Machalat, what does Limchol mean?
Slicha, from the word to forgive, to pardon.
Yes, pardon. Mechila means to forgive. There is a saying that when a person gets married, they are forgiven all their sins.
That's the great mitzvah.
Because it's such a beautiful thing, getting married, one enters a new spiritual state, and it's like Yom Kippur. That's why a bride and groom fast on the day of their marriage.
But this would encourage people to marry more and more. Each time you get forgiven all your sins.
Well, you have to pit that against Rabbeinu Gershon, who said you can only marry one. So, this is intriguing, that the idea of being forgiven all one's sins on the one's wedding day is learned from the wedding of Esau and Machalat. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe discusses this. He says, you know, Machalat was actually a very spiritual person. This young lady, the daughter of Ishmael, the rabbis tell us that Ishmael repented in the end and did not behave, he behaved in a good way. For example, when Abraham passed away, Isaac and Ishmael together buried him. We had that in the end of last week's session. So Ishmael really, he became a fine person, and his daughter is a very spiritual person.
The granddaughter of Abraham, she wishes
peace with his brother.
And that is actually the good dimension of Esau. There is a good dimension of Esau. Now there's a midrash that tells us that when they wanted to bury Jacob, in the grave of the Machpelah in Hebron, in the grave where Abraham, Isaac, and so on are buried. Esau tried to prevent this. And there was a fight, and Esau was killed, and his head was cut off.
Oh, I remember that story.
And his head rolled into the grave. So Esau's head is buried together with the patriarchs. You've got Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Leah, and Sarah, and Rebecca, and Esau's head. Now, why Esau's head?
Because it's the brain and not the heart.
Well, because ultimately, Esau is good. It is just that the gum is a problem. And in fact, that is the nature of the animal soul. Yeah. The animal soul, which can lust in a very negative way, really is something holy if we can just remove what's described as the sackcloth garment which surrounds him. And so therefore we have this concept that what looks like a polarity of positive and negative, white and black, in fact it's not that. It's that ultimately everything has a positive potential and is good.
What happened to his soul and his head when his soul?
Well, the sages tell us that Ishmael, although he is described as repentant at the end of his days, he's still outside the family of Abraham. Ultimately, he's a non-Jew. Whereas Esau is a Jew who is not behaving well. And so Esau is seen as someone who ultimately will be transformed into a positive way. So in that sense, although he had terrible progeny like Amalek, but nonetheless descended from Esau were some very great rabbis. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Akiva, they are from the people of Esau, who, taking Esau as Rome in that, or however we take them, I mean, it's really before the whole Roman connection, but it links into that as well. But they are seen as descendants of Esau, who became leaders of our people. Mm-hmm. So there we have the Jacob and Esau.
Now, if Esau has a positive side, what's the negative side of Jacob?
Well, I think the ultimate teaching of the Torah is that everything is good. It's not that it's balanced.
No, but
the
dice
is loaded.
Jacob
is good, and the dice is loaded that even Esau is also good, ultimately. All right.
But doesn't it get any black marks for deceiving his father?
The interesting thing is that it's the mother that initiated it, and there's a lot of talking about Rivka and I think it's a fascinating topic. Now you've got two sons, and you actually plainly prefer one to the other, and you deceive your husband as well. It's not only that you're creating a war that would last forever, but you're also deceiving the father of the children, who is blind. It's an appalling story when you think about it.
Okay, so let's try very briefly to understand it in Kabbalistic terms. Okay.
Sorry. I'm a provocateur tonight.
Now, we learnt about the idea of tzimtzum, the concealment of the divine, which is the step before the creation, that the divine has to be hidden, otherwise the infinite radiance of God would prevent the formation of a finite world. And then we have the concept of the breaking of the vessels, shvirat ha-kelim, the breaking of the vessels, that there was a process of radiance entering these vessels, these sort of primeval sphirot, the divine emanations. And then there was the breaking of the vessels because the radiance was too intense. So there is, if we put at the top, there is the infinite. And then we have this level of this very intense radiance, which is called Orot of Tohu, the radiance of chaos.
Oh, never heard that one before.
Orot of Tohu, the radiance, like Tohu Vavohu.
Tohu Vavohu. Okay.
Right, so the radiance of chaos. Now, that is a very exalted spiritual level, and it is too, the radiance is too intense. And we are in a lower level, which is called the world of Tikkun, the world of repair. And the world of repair is the Sfirot as we understand them, coming down into the world below. Now, Jacob represents the world of repair. Esau represents the radiance of chaos. Isaac was able to see the grandeur that is in Esau. And that is why he loved him.
He loved him even more.
Because he saw that there's this greatness, this tremendous power in him. Rivka, she realized that the only way forward is for Jacob to be on top, as it said in the prophecy to her. The more powerful one will serve the younger one, the smaller one. And that means she understood that what has to happen is you have to have the world of Tikkun, and through the world of Tikkun, Esau will be transformed into something positive. As Esau is at the moment, his force is negative. It's very grand, but it's powerful, and it's uncontrolled, and it's negative. Now then comes the blessing. Isaac wants to give the blessing to Esau. He believes that by giving the blessing, that will be a divine flow coming to Esau. And that divine flow will, as it were, heal Esau and make him, will bring about tikkun for him. Rebecca realizes this is the wrong path. That if you provide this divine flow directly to Esau, it will just exaggerate his megalomaniac possibilities. She said, no, the divine flow of the blessing has to go to Jacob. And then Jacob will be able to encapsulate Esau and utilize and reveal the positive dimension of Esau, the head of Esau, which is within the grave of the Machpelah, which is part of holiness. Why does it all have to happen in this deceitful way? Because the problem in existence comes about because of the deceitful happenings in the Garden of Eden with the snake, and Eve. And so therefore the snake tricked Eve, and because of that we were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, and the world is filled with all kinds of pain and problem, including the pain of childbirth. And it's Rebecca who is reversing the whole process with a painful pregnancy, and she re-transforms the whole thing and tricks her husband in order that this should reach the right kind of tikkun, bringing to a world of wholeness and
oneness.
So this is
goodness. This sounds like they're much smarter than the patriarchs. I mean, this is amazing. Smarter than her husband.
Well, yes. I mean, that's we see all the way along. The Sarah having a greater level of Ruach HaKodesh, of the Divine Spirit, than Abraham, that we saw in last week's session.
Yes, all of them have such little space in the Torah. They talk a lot about Abraham, a lot about Yitzchak, a lot about Moshe, very little about Miriam, very little about...
Sentence.
Yes, it's just...
Yeah, they only need that one.
It's true, in this case they only need the one sentence.
I understand, but you have to go to that level to have someone like Tully to explain it. Yes. And otherwise you just look at these texts and you think, why are those women so...
Yeah.
They seem so shallow when you read the text.
Well, they don't look shallow. They look fascinating. They're never shallow.
Or maybe the world is not shallow. But look, my misconception of her and I used really some really awful word to describe her. She looked deceitful. She sounded deceitful. Her
action was.
But when you
she deceived her husband.
But yes, but when you understand why.
Yeah, but still deceived her husband. You're right. She deceived her husband.
But the purpose in life is
deception.
No. It's beyond pleasing your husband. Yeah, of course.
Deception.
Yeah, it started a long, long time ago.
Look, it's a falsche Welt.
Yes.
It's saying Yiddish. It's a false world. And the way in which a person has to deal with the world, you have to be arum b'yira, cunning with fear of God. And it's through certain kinds of deception of our animal self. We can deceive our animal self and persuade it to be transformed into a divine.
Good.
Yeah.
I like that. This is still on, isn't it? This last phrase. It's a very good one. I have to listen to it again.
This conception of the head in the grave. Now, if we put it in today's sense, well, we're not allowed to bury somebody only one part. We have to find every part.
If we can.
If we can.
Yeah, I mean, if we only have the head, then we would have buried the head.
Yeah, but in this case, you did have the whole body, so it's symbolic. It must be symbolic. Mm.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, it's his head which was buried in that sacred grave. I don't remember.
Is this the reason why it is sacred to the... Except for Abraham, obviously, who is there, to the Arabs?
Well, I mean, that's why the...
Okay. That was fascinating.
Thank you.